From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. In the first week since his COVID-19 diagnosis and after his doctor said he is no longer infectious to others, U.S. President Donald Trump returned to the campaign trail, holding rallies in battleground states that he won in 2016 and must carry to win in 2020. Trump and Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden are literally crisscrossing those battleground states this week to energize their supporters and refine their messages as the election looms less than 3 weeks away. U.S. Supreme Court nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett was on Capitol Hill to take questions from the Senate. Barrett deflected a range of inquiries on issues impacting a wide range of Americans, from abortion to health care to gun rights, insisting she would not bring her own agenda to the bench if she is confirmed to the nation's highest court. But Democratic senators expressed concern over her refusal to confirm her position on fundamental issues such as the peaceful transfer of power. Global COVID-19 cases have surpassed 38 million, with the U.S., India, and Brazil accounting for more than half of the world's recorded infections. According to researchers, small gatherings are a growing source of coronavirus spread in the U.S. And the U.S. attorney tasked by Attorney General William Barr to review instances of unmasking done around the 2016 election has completed the probe without bringing any charges or a public report. Panelists, Linda, JJ, thanks so much for joining digitally here this week. Let's get started with the election and campaigning in the U.S. The rallies of President Donald Trump have resumed. They are in battleground states. As we mentioned, virtually no sign of social distancing or mask wearing at these events, which draw tens of thousands of people. The president's message seems to be that he got over it and that there isn't anything to worry about. We're just a couple of weeks away from Election Day, and the one thing that you never get back in a campaign, I'm told, is time. So where and how these campaigns choose to spend their time could very well decide this contest. I'll start with you, Linda. Where is the Trump campaign going, focusing its time, and what is their message at these rallies?
The Trump campaign is playing defense. As you noted, he's campaigning in states that he won last time. These were battleground states that, frankly, Hillary Clinton thought she was going to win and didn't campaign in at all, or, you know, took a rather light approach to ensuring that they voted for her. So that's a good sign for Joe Biden. Donald Trump plans to campaign literally every day, travel every day between now and Election Day. He seems to have boundless energy. He's certainly demonstrating that you can recover from COVID and pick up life as usual. Of course, he had the best treatment, the best health care on the planet with a team of doctors at Walter Reed Hospital and his personal physician overseeing his care. But the fact remains that he does look pretty good. His message of nothing to see here, I had COVID, I did fine, my family got it, they're fine, that might play well with some people, but it also strikes me as in some ways a wasted opportunity. He could have used his own battle with COVID as an opportunity to show perhaps a little humility, show a little empathy for the 215,000 Americans who have died of this disease. But he chose not to go there. He believes that illness is weakness, and he is, above all else, one who loves to show strength. So that's his message going forward. He's not going to get out of his own campaign bubble all that much. He'll do a town hall on NBC, which is not his bailiwick, but for the most part, he's sticking to friendly territory, trying to keep his base of support energized and voting.
JJ, the states that the president has been visiting include Florida, Iowa, Pennsylvania. These are states that are critical for both campaigns, let's be honest, to win the swing states. We know that this election is going to come down to a few key swing state votes. As you see it, the Trump message, and when you look at the rallies, to Linda's point, the messaging that the rallies themselves are sending, are these rallies seen by people as being bold or just flat out dangerous?
Well, they're a bit of both. And thanks, Michael, for that question. And considering that I am not able to offer any opinions on politics, considering the role that I play as a national security correspondent, I have to look at it from the other side. It is bold and it is dangerous, but here's what's happening behind the bold and the dangerous. There is a massive effort underway from foreign players and some domestic as well to impact whatever it is that people perceive that the president is saying. You have a major effort in Russia underway. There's China as well. There are other players like Iran that are in this game as well. You have domestic players as well. This week, we heard about an effort to possibly kidnap two sitting governors, one from Michigan and one from Virginia. And beneath that message were their concerns about how these people who are Democrats dealt with COVID-19. As you were talking about, the president and his, quote, recovery from COVID-19 has impacted what he said significantly. So people from these foreign organizations and from some of the domestic ones are trying to seize upon those comments and everything that the president has said to try to push their message. Their goal is to try to impact the election and maybe shift voters' thinking.
Linda, let's go to the Biden campaign, and when we talk about his visits, because he's going from state to state also, certainly not in the same way and holding the same types of events that the Trump administration chooses to hold, the Trump campaign, I should say. Biden's spending his time, and what's his message focused around? Because it seems as though COVID-19 is his core message and that all issues flow from that, the handling of coronavirus.
Right. So he's also doing a lot of travel to battleground states. He's traveling to his native state of Pennsylvania. He's spending a lot of time in Florida, which is smart, because if he can beat Donald Trump in Florida, it's game over. Donald Trump has to win Florida. Joe Biden doesn't have to win Florida, but it's such a big state that it's kind of one-stop shopping. The Biden message is really all about, let's get back to normal. Let's get back to a country that believes in empathy and civility, which we haven't had for the past 4 years in his telling. It's kind of a return to the Obama presidency, but not. There was some unhappiness with Obama by the end that I think helped fuel the rise toward Trump. So he can't completely wrap himself in the mantle of Barack Obama. But having said that, I will point out that President Obama is planning to do a lot of campaigning in these remaining couple of weeks to really buttress President Obama's former vice president, and in particular to rally the black vote, the Hispanic vote, other demographics that were very strong for President Obama and who Joe Biden really needs to turn out for him.
And JJ, I'll finish with you. I looked at the numbers for fundraising, and sadly, fundraising is such a key part of electioneering here in the United States. Joe Biden is raising record amounts of money, and there are reports that the Trump campaign funds are dwindling, if not completely expired. How much of a factor will that play in the closing days of the election, just the amount of money that the campaigns have to spend on these two candidates?
Not knowing a whole lot about how politics works from a repertorial point of view, but just from a citizen's point of view and observing just what I have learned over my lifetime, it plays a big role because the person or the campaign with the most money generally reaches the most people using the traditional media. So it's going to play a significant role in that process for both candidates. And I can say as well, people recognize as well today that there are other sources of, shall we say, media where campaign messages can be put out there. And people are using some of those sources to put messages out there, which give both candidates an opportunity to use your money more wisely or use it in places where it counts. But there is an awful lot of other options that they can use to make their money go further.
Indeed, with the rise of online politics, online advertising, and also the rise of the cable news networks, you have a lot of coverage being given in untraditional places to both the candidates. And again, with just a couple of weeks to go, it's going to be a sprint to the finish. Let's move on to the U.S. Supreme Court hearings, where nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett took questions from the Senate. I have to say, it is not a riveting show to watch. It's rather like watching or listening to paint dry, really, with senators posing questions, very sort of long, elaborate speeches leading up to a very short question with an obvious answer, a bit of theater on both sides there. But that is, of course, the United States Senate. What were the more significant lines of questioning that you can extract from these very long days that we've had for the Senate committee and for Judge Barrett.
Buttressing this entire process is the very, very strong promises from President Trump to put Supreme Court justices in place who will overturn the Affordable Care Act, who will overturn Roe v. Wade, the longstanding Supreme Court precedent that protects the right to abortion nationally, and other conservative positions. So Amy Coney Barrett comes in there as a conservative jurist, but not wanting to tip her hand at all how she might rule on any particular case. This approach to testifying for Supreme Court nominations is nothing new. All nominees have learned since Robert Bork, when he went down in flames a few decades ago, that you really have to keep your cards close to the vest. And indeed, a prospective justice can't know the exact specifics of a case that might come before them or how they might rule. So Amy Coney Barrett, she was a clerk for Justice Scalia, who was a lion of conservative jurisprudence, and she, like him, would be a voice for what's called originalism or textualism, which are principles that hold that the Constitution and statutory law should be interpreted according to their publicly understood meaning at the time of passage. So you would look to the Constitution and what was meant at the time it was passed. And, you know, Democrats and liberals tend to say that the Constitution is a living document and that we need to be a little more flexible. She is, as a human being, she's bulletproof. She's a woman, of course, which means the chances that she's engaged in some kind of sexual harassment or assault, as Justice Kavanaugh was, that the chances are very low that that would be the case. She has 7 children. She is a devout Catholic. Republicans tried to use that to get the Democrats to use that as a negative, but that was effectively neutralized before the hearing even started. So it really just became all about her conservative past, some letters she had signed, some public statements she had made about issues like abortion. But really, this is really just a formality, and she'll be on the court.
JJ, Senator Cory Booker asked Judge Barrett during her confirmation if president should unequivocally commit to a peaceful transition. Her answer was, "That seems to me to be pulling me into the question of whether the president has said he would not leave office. To the extent that this is a political controversy right now, as a judge, I would want to stay out of it, and I don't want to express a view. It would seem to me to be a very clear-cut issue and also a significant national security issue about whether or not the peaceful transfer of power would be respected or is respected by this particular judge." How do you see this answer in terms of a national security issue, and is President Trump looking to win the election in the courts rather than at the ballot box?
It won't matter what Judge Coney Barrett thinks. If this comes to it and the time comes for the president to leave office, if that is what the voters choose, then there is a system in place that essentially makes sure that that happens. If there is some question about votes or some question about processes, then that's something that most likely the Supreme Court or other courts and the Supreme Court may have a vote on. But if it comes down to the very simple fact of if this president loses the election and he chooses not to go, there are people within the U.S. government, i.e. law enforcement, Secret Service, and U.S. Marshals, not the military, Secret Service and U.S. Marshals, that are tasked with making sure that happens. So I don't think it will really matter what she thinks.
Let's take a break. We'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. And our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. As we mentioned in the open, cases are growing of COVID-19 in the United States and in Europe. President Emmanuel Macron of France has imposed a nighttime curfew, stating the virus is everywhere in France. In the U.S., state-by-state policy is continuing with a range of policies on social distancing, mask wearing, and restrictions on public gatherings, making the virus very difficult, if not impossible, to control on a nationwide basis. JJ, I'll start with you again. The president says that the virus is under control. Is there any evidence to support that?
None that I can find. And here's why this whole idea is important for everyone to understand. The president appears to be feeling better than he was almost 2 weeks ago. A couple of weeks ago, there were reports that he was short of breath. There were reports that he needed oxygen. There were reports that he was not doing well, and he was rushed to Walter Reed Army Medical Center, where he got some expert care, care that most folks can't get, and most people would not be able to attain the kind of treatments that he got. He goes back to the White House, and we learned that, of course, we learned this before, that the First Lady was impacted, but we also learned there is a significant White House resident staff. There are almost 100 people that work there. And I've been told through my reporting that at least a half dozen people there have been impacted. And here's why this is important. Many of those people are elderly. Many of them are African Americans. And that puts these people squarely in the bullseye for a bad outcome for COVID-19. So this situation with where we are on COVID-19 not being a factor or supposedly being under control is simply not true. We've heard that his son, his 14-year-old son, Barron Trump, tested positive as well. This is another example of how this is not under control. And I think people around the world are recognizing it. People in the U.S. certainly recognize it. The scientists recognize it. So it's important for the rest of the people here in this nation to recognize it as well, because it is a deadly, deadly, deadly disease.
Linda, JJ points out a conflict, an open conflict between the Trump administration and his supporters, both in office and among the citizenry, an open conflict with their opinion that the virus is under control and should be acknowledged but shouldn't run your lives. He's in open conflict with experts like Dr. Anthony Fauci, an infectious disease expert. Is there anything such as an impartial, trusted source that can bring these two sides of an argument together that's become political when it's really a medical issue?
Exactly. No, I mean, I think we should be listening to the experts and the scientists. I mean, Anthony Fauci is the leading epidemiologist in the United States. Anthony Fauci is saying that Americans may need to cancel their Thanksgiving plans. Maybe we shouldn't be gathering with our elderly relatives for Christmas and, you know, traveling and hanging out together in enclosed spaces. I mean, there are safe ways to do that. There are ways to engage in social activities that are safe, particularly when the weather is nice and you can hang out outside. It's fall. We're heading into the winter. The prediction was that cases would rise in the fall and into the winter, and it is indeed happening. We're seeing rises in 40 states with infections. You know, we could be upwards of 300,000 deaths before long. When Donald Trump says, don't let it dominate your life, I understand what he's saying. He's saying don't do nothing. Don't feel that you have to literally cower under the bed at home and let it destroy your life as a healthy person. I mean, if he was, I think, being a smart leader, he would urge us all to wear masks and engage in social distancing. I mean, the simple practices that have been recommended from the very start are still recommended. And all it would have taken was for him to recommend that to everybody. But he didn't do that. So it's become this hugely divisive issue.
To Linda's point, JJ, the mask wearing would be the thing that would allow people to get out, to it would seem, what the experts are saying. But that seems to be such a contentious point, with some people, many people, outright refusing to wear a mask and declaring it a declaration of their liberty, oddly. Let me ask you this. As we take a look at what that mask wearing is and could be, and the prospect for a vaccine, we've had several doctors say openly that given the choice between a mask and a vaccine, they'd rather have a mask. But vaccines are on the horizon. How far out are they? And given the sort of air of skepticism that's in the air, how effective are they likely to be?
That's a great point, Michael. People's fear is really the key here. Whether or not people can muster whatever is necessary to put them in a position where they're safest is the key thing here that I think all of the politicians are hopefully working on. But here's the problem with all of this. There's just been so much misinformation, so much disinformation, and so much chaos in this whole process, which, by the way, is a major national security concern right now. People just simply don't know what to do. Regardless of what the politicians say at this point, some people are dug in on their points of view, even to the point where it could kill them. Seeing some television excerpts in the last couple of days where people were told you could lose your life if you don't wear a mask between now and when a vaccine is developed. And some of them say, well, you know, if it's my time, it's my time. If that's their view, then there's nothing, sadly, that we can do about that if it's not going to change. But I can say this to you, that when people are able to trust that a vaccine is ready, I'm pretty sure the scientists are going to tell us about it. And as soon as that happens, I can guarantee you people will be rushing out to get them. But in the meantime, people are concerned because they haven't heard that yet. And that's why you have this mask or vaccine kind of situation right now. As Dr. Anthony Fauci said, at the end of the year, the first of next year, those vaccines will become available. The most vulnerable will get them first, and then others will get them later on in the year. But the process will start, and I think that will relieve some of the mental stress on people where they're making these decisions to do these things, which may cost them their lives.
I want to take just a couple of minutes to talk about the unmasking story. This from the Washington Post. The federal prosecutor appointed by Attorney General William P. Barr to review whether Obama-era officials improperly requested the identities of individuals whose names were redacted in intelligence documents has completed his work without finding any substantive wrongdoing, according to people familiar with the matter. Post goes on to say that the department has so far declined to release the results of the attorney's work, though people familiar with his findings say that they would likely disappoint conservatives who have tried to paint the unmasking of names. This is a common practice in government to help understand classified documents as a political conspiracy. JD, I'll start with you just for a comment on this one. Just point blank, with your experience in this world, is this a national security concern?
Not from what this investigation was based on, because as you mentioned, this is a common practice. It's been going on for a while. The problem with this is it got to a point where resources, time, and people's actual days and weeks and months were consumed who work at the Justice Department on this, most of them realizing that it was not going to go anywhere. And those people may have lost opportunities to focus on more critical things that impact the Justice Department. The Attorney General said recently that he wasn't aware of this investigation that turned up a plot to kidnap the Democratic governor of Michigan. There are those who say that he should have known about it. And there are those that say it's almost impossible to say that he didn't know about it. But nevertheless, he said it, and we have to take him at his word until we find out otherwise. But this is a part of what I think those distractions in the Justice Department and other places do to people in critical roles. This is a situation that shouldn't have happened.
And Lida, I'll finish with you. I think many conservatives were looking to this report to be the, air quotes, October surprise, as they say in political terms, a surprise that shakes up or changes opinions late in a presidential election. Do you think that there is any significant political impact from this? And does it affect William Barr's status with president?
Well, the president has been very critical of Attorney General Barr lately, perhaps suggesting that Mr. Barr would not be asked to stay for a second term if Donald Trump was reelected. I think the Trump team has perhaps hoped for many October surprises that could help them. I mean, we also have the situation with the computer that allegedly belonged to Hunter Biden that supposedly contained an email suggesting that maybe he had introduced his father, the then vice president, to a key person in Ukraine. This brings back the whole Ukraine story. That's a whole completely separate whirlwind. All these situations involving murky legal matters, most voters aren't paying attention to that and aren't going to sit down and figure them out. We're having a pandemic. The economy is in terrible shape. This is what voters care about. It's hard to imagine any October surprise that could top the very real human challenges that we're facing right now.
I think you're absolutely right on that. And basically, an understanding that the pandemic is the economy, is the election, is probably key to where these two candidates are going to have to shift their message as they come to the close of this election cycle. That is all the time we have for this week. Thanks to our panelists, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. This program is produced by the Voice of America, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.